From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1849 with an ad in the newspaper. It was titled, quote, $300 reward. The piece was written by a slaveholder in Maryland who was seeking the return of three slaves. One was named Minty and was described as, quote, aged about 27 years, is of chestnut color, fine looking, and about 5 feet high, end quote. A $50 reward was listed for her capture if taken in the state, and a $100 reward was listed if taken out of the state. Minty was short for Arminta. You'd know her today by a different name, Harriet Tubman. Tubman was born into slavery in 1822. You likely are familiar with her work, of course, from the Underground Railroad, through which she helped bring hundreds of slaves to freedom. But on the whole, due to the circumstances of her life in bondage, less is known of her life and work than some of her peers in the abolitionist movement, people like Martha Coffin Wright and Frances Seward. All of their work was critical to ending slavery and to securing women's rights in this country. What can all three women teach modern-day Americans about social justice? And are there parallels between the era leading up to the Civil War and the current state of the country? These are questions Dorothy Wickenden explores in her book, The Agitators. Wickenden is the executive editor of The New Yorker, and she will lead a virtual talk through, I should say, a virtual talk about The Agitators at the University of Rochester, and that's next week. But first, she's joining us right here on Connections. Dorothy Wickenden, congratulations on this book, and thank you for making time for the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you've got some roots close enough to us, and in fact, we are broadcasting on WXXI and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio out of Geneva and Hobart and William Smith Colleges, where you attended, yes?
I did indeed.
I hope it was fond memories.
Very fond memories. And it was actually my time there provided, now looking back, provided the early, you know, glimmerings of what part of what this book was to become, because as you know, that part of New York State was very radical in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm. Well, these three stories, you know, certainly they are interesting historical figures in their own right, and your book weaves together the three women's stories, which, you know, is certainly an important but daunting task. Martha and Frances were connected through abolitionists and were neighbors in Auburn, but you say that how they became connected with Tubman is a little bit harder to pin down. So why did you decide to bring their three stories together in one book here?
It is a little hard to pin down, but it probably began, I think I just became absolutely determined to tell this joint story because my grandmother grew up in Auburn, New York, and family lore had it that when she and her best friend, Rosamond Underwood, were standing basically across the street from where the Seward House Museum is today, they were four or five, and up the street, I was told, on a bicycle, rode Harriet Tubman. And so I was working on my earlier book, which was about my grandmother and that friend, totally different story. But as I was finishing that book, I couldn't get that image out of my mind. And I just kept asking myself, how did Harriet Tubman, who, as you said in the opening, who spent her first 27 years enslaved on the Eastern Shore, come to spend almost 50 years of her life in Auburn, New York? And to answer that question, I soon discovered that I really needed to understand how the Underground Railroad worked, and very specifically, how different kinds of people whom you wouldn't necessarily put together if you didn't understand this incredible network, how they did it. So even someone as you know, extraordinary as Harriet Tubman, there was no one like her in American history. Even she needed contacts and close friends, people she could trust. And she ended two of them. She had quite a wide network among, you know, noteworthy abolitionists in Philadelphia, Boston, and across New York State. But two of her closest friends and allies were these other two women. And it just seemed to me it was a great way to tell the story of the kind of joint story of abolition and women's rights, because those two movements, those great social movements of the 19th century, were completely intertwined. So That was the beginning of it. I knew it was going to be ambitious. I thought probably if I'd known quite how hard it was going to be, I might not have attempted it. But, you know, no end of interesting things to discover, and I'm still discovering new things.
I want to ask you a little bit about maybe some of the research that you had to conduct here, some of it in the Department of Rare Books and Special Collections at the University of Rochester. Back in 2014, we welcomed the author of a biography of William Seward, and the epistolary nature of Seward's life and the people in his life certainly makes that easier. The surviving letters are many, and they're fascinating to read, but it still makes constructing a narrative difficult. And on top of that, you write in a way that brings people, you know, sometimes to these moments that are really rather poignant. And if I could just read just as an example, and then maybe ask you to kind of let listeners in on how you know this stuff happened and how much is sure. speculation and how much is really well verified. Just as an example, you write about in A Young Lady of Means, you write about Frances, and you write that Frances left Augustus with her father and Aunt Clara, but she couldn't bear to part with Frederick, so he accompanied them on a 3-month excursion through Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and Washington. The specialist had no remedy, but Frances's mood improved as she experienced ordinary family pleasures, picnics, long conversations with Henry, gathering wildflowers, and reading under the shade of a tree as he fished for trout with Fred. In southern Pennsylvania and Maryland, strawberries and melons were ripening in the fields. As they traveled into Virginia, the roads became rougher and the farmhouses, taverns, and shops fewer and farther between. In terms of industrial progress, the state was 100 years behind New York, and the blight of slavery was pervasive. Virginia enslaved 470,000 people, nearly half its population. The legislature had become even more punitive after Nat Turner's armed revolt in 1831, forbidding slaves to hold religious meetings, leave the property without a written pass, and to read and write. Stopping one morning in the countryside to rest at an inn, Frances went to speak to a black woman, elderly and blind, who was laboriously turning the wheel of a farm machine. The woman told Frances that her husband and 6 children had been sold, and that she had never heard from them again. Frances asked, "Do you not find it hard to bear up under such afflictions?" The woman answered with wrenching resignation, "Why, yes, mistress, but God does what he thinks is best with us." End quote. Remarkable level of detail in the story. So tell us about how some of your work led you to be able to tell that story.
Yeah, so for that, I have to thank the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, which does, as you say, that is where the Seward, the entire vast Seward papers are kept. And Frances had a journal that she kept during that southern trip. And so almost all of the very specific details came directly from her journal. Then there was even more about the conversations she and Henry, as she called her husband, had in the carriage, and their black coachman who sat on the front, the front with their young son. And Frances wrote, as did her friend Martha, just wrote so vividly about her experiences that it was not that hard, actually. You have to sew that into the narrative, but it was quite easy for me to see after that trip, and there was another really terrible encounter, which we can talk about if you want, how she came back from that trip. She had always been anti-slavery, as had her husband, but she had never seen enslaved people before, spoken to them. So it was just a real shock to her. And she came back a committed abolitionist. And that was, you know, this very recessive, she had a sickly, aristocratic woman. You never would have expected that she would have had this incredibly tumultuous inner life and that she would then go on to act upon it, which she did. And so she became more and more fascinating to me as I delved deeper into the letters. And I discovered, despite, you know, the fine biographies by Walter Starr and many other biographers by now of William Henry Seward, almost all of Frances's letters which are now being digitized at the library. At that point, almost no one had ever read this every other day correspondence between Frances and her husband. Frances stayed in Auburn. She had no interest in living in Washington, which was a notorious slave town. She hated politics. So her husband, when he became a senator from New York, and then eventually Lincoln's Secretary of State, he lived in a house in Washington. She lived in her parental house in Auburn, where she spent her entire life. And they wrote to each other very, very faithfully. And all of this is in the letters. And it was, so I, just had this incredible gift as a researcher, that the fact that even though Frances had been cited very, very spottily in other biographies, no one had ever really looked at her life. And I was interested in telling the story of these three women. I wanted to understand, I wanted to tell American history from the point of view of the powerless. And women, white women, who had no legal rights at all at the time. Of course, they were not treated nearly as terribly as enslaved women were. But the truth is, as I came to see, Harriet Tubman and Martha Coffin Wright and Frances Seward had far more in common than one would ever initially assume. And in some ways, they had more in common with each other than they did with their own husbands.
Well, on the subject of Frances Seward, before we turn to the other of the three women who are the agitators named in the book, talking to Walter Starr on this program, I really appreciated his book. And what I certainly, of the many things I learned from that book, one of them was that Frances and Henry, William Seward, had different views of the speed of which slavery ought to have been abolished and the urgency and the necessity. And she was often frustrated by a number of things. I mean, I think his book touches on it. Your book does as well. He goes off and is sort of traveling the world, traveling the country, and he has ambitions becoming governor, ambitions to perhaps become president, and becomes part of Lincoln's cabinet. She is in Auburn, maybe a little bit limited, but still burning with ambition and a frustration that things aren't as urgent in her husband's mind, or at least the process of getting things done. Some of those letters that Walter Starr published were so interesting. And then this book, I think, just further brings the point that this was an extraordinary person who wasn't just somebody's wife. Sometimes we talk about women today, but certainly women throughout history as, oh, well, that was William Seward's wife, or, and Frances was her own person with her own views on it, even if they sometimes differed from her husband. Can you elaborate on some of that?
Yes, sure. Absolutely, she was. Although it was hard, it took a while for her to completely find her own voice, because, of course, women were brought up not to have any voice at all. Mm-hmm. And she was a very dutiful daughter, and she thought she was going to lead this quiet life. And she initially thought that Seward was going to be this local lawyer, and they would bring up their children in Auburn, and they would live essentially the way, the previous generation had lived. And of course, they were caught up in this incredibly tumultuous time in American history. And she, after that trip in 1835, and even before that, after she, in 2 years earlier, when she had discovered that her dear sister Lizette was being brutalized by her husband, and she suddenly realized women, they can't divorce because they'll lose everything they ever had, including their children and their inheritances. And so that opened her eyes to the injustice of women's lot in life, and the absurdity and narrowness of the divorce laws at the time. So there she was, an early advocate of women's rights, an early advocate of abolition. She was incredibly well-read. She had a very good education for a woman of that era. And she started reading all the abolitionist newspapers and pamphlets and all kinds of incendiary material. And Martha, her only close friend in Auburn, used to stop by whenever she could get out of the house, because she had six young children. She would stop by and she would borrow whatever she could from Frances's and Henry's extensive library and read it. And then these two women would kind of conspire together behind the scenes. But it took them years to figure out what they could actually do, because they were wives and mothers of young children. And the avenues for them weren't entirely clear. And then eventually in 1843, Martha, and we'll talk about her in a moment, she decided to join the Underground Railroad. So she turned her basement kitchen into a haven for fugitive slaves. And that Frances had to wait for her father, her conservative judge father, to die. And so it was about a decade later, Frances did the same thing. And she turned her original basement kitchen into a haven for fugitive slaves. And that was how ultimately she got connected, the two women got connected to Harriet Tubman.
Martha Wright, I think, is the name that most readers and listeners to this program will know the least about. And the New York Times, reviewing the book, has said that this was a person stymied by history and has largely been hidden from it since. Why is that?
Oh, and it's such a, this was one of the things I had to tell her story, because she was such a forceful woman. She was a complete rebel from the time she was born. I mean, she just had this in her. She came from a very strong Quaker family. Her father died when she was really young, and her mother was this indomitable figure, as was her much older sister, Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker minister and very much an abolitionist and an advocate for human rights of all kinds. So she was brought up by these two formidable women. Her mother ran her own shop, and these women took for granted that they were men's equal. So when Martha got married young and she started having children, she couldn't stand it. She hated staying at home all day with the children while her husband David, who was a lawyer, was able to travel for work. He had so many interesting, intellectually, demanding things to think about as he started his law practice. So when she had time, she would kind of glance at his law books. She stopped her own education when she was 15. So she was filled with rage at all of these injustices. And she would spill out her feelings to her sister, Lucretia Mott. So her letters, too, are just this incredible hidden record of what women really were thinking, and some of them, a small number of them, were actually doing behind the scenes. And she was very funny in an acid way. And so she would write very openly to Lucretia about, David. So, for instance, they had in the early 1840s, she had these children. They were middle class. They didn't have enough money. Finally, they had enough money. And imagine, there were no sewing machines. She had to make all of the family's clothes by hand, among all the many other domestic chores she had. It was just never ending. She woke up before dawn. She went to bed at midnight. She was exhausted all the time. Finally, they have enough money to hire a seamstress. And so Martha, and this is all in the letters, Martha tells David, I would like Miss Soule, the seamstress, we should pay her the same wages that you pay your outdoor man the work he does for you. And he said, he just thought that was outrageous. He said, well, you couldn't possibly do that. That would be a curse to the community. And so here is Martha, and she's right there. She argues with him back and forth. And then finally, he gets so frustrated, as she writes in her letter to Lucretia, he went off to hoe his corn or cut asparagus. He wouldn't hear any more of this nonsense. But again, when you think about this was hundreds of years before Congress got around to passing an Equal Pay Act for women. And of course, women still don't make, for the most part, what men make. So she was just, these women were way, way, way ahead of their time. And as such, they were real radicals. And so you asked earlier about the difference between William Henry Seward's politics and Frances's politics. So Seward was a politician, and politicians, their job consists of making compromises. Mm-hmm. And Frances just hated that. And she was an outsider. And so everything she read was about abolition. And so she kept her, she was basically his political confidant and conscience. And so she wrote to him constantly about you have to move more quickly on abolition. You can't keep cutting corners. You know, this is of vital importance. These are human beings we're talking about, as Seward well knew, because he was a politician, he was a very outspoken opponent of slavery. But he wasn't an abolitionist who believed that you could just ignore the Constitution and do away with slavery, you know, instantly.
Sure. And let's sort of close the loop on what you hinted at earlier, because when you think about a politician thinking about compromise versus his wife, who is an agitator, this story in the book is one of the reasons that Frances felt the way she did. Now, this is not easy to read. It may be, you know, it's going to be upsetting for some people to hear. I'll just warn you, but I'll just read from some of this passage here. Another day, as the Sewards pulled up at a tavern north of Richmond, they heard the sounds of weeping and moaning and saw 10 naked boys between 6 and 12 years old tied together by their wrists and fastened to a long rope, being driven forward by a tall white man holding a whip. They watched with horror as he led them to a horse trough to drink and then to a shed where they lay down, sobbing themselves to sleep. The slave trader had bought the children from several plantations, and he was taking them to Richmond, where they would be sold at auction. A few of the tens of thousands of people Virginia supplied to the cotton and rice fields of the Deep South every year. And you go on to say that Frances would, she would think about that at night. She would close her eyes and cry and think about those ragged, sobbing boys. And she would write about it in her journal. She called it evil. She went back to Auburn eventually, feeling that there was a real sense of injustice that just was burning with her. How significant was that moment? On the page, it jumps out at you. It's very difficult to read. How significant was that in her life?
Well, it was one of the turning points. And so, as I alluded to earlier, she had what you just read was on that same trip south, and where so they had these two encounters with slavery, which were deeply upsetting. And then she had seen, and before that, she had seen her sister being beaten, badly beaten by her husband. And so it was those two things that just completely changed her way of thinking about the, not completely, because she had nominally believed in women's rights and opposed slavery before that, but to experience them herself, she decided, and she was a deeply religious Episcopalian, and she believed, as the Quakers did, that slavery was a sin, and you know, if you were confronted with any kind of deep injustice, it was incumbent upon you to do something about it. So that was what goaded her. It was what goaded Martha, and it was what goaded Harriet Tubman, who, of course, had horrific firsthand experiences with slavery.
You also, if I could just ask a little bit about the Freeman case, that there's so much here that I think is going to be brand new, even for people who are students of history, and the question of mental illness and just thinking about what that means in defense cases. And you write about, I keep saying William Seward, Henry Seward's efforts to take on a case, and the way that Frances became sort of fascinated by mental illness as not only a defense in a case of violence, but also enough to kind of to go back and start thinking about mental illness in general. And I don't think society in the last 20 years has thought more about mental illness than we did in the previous thousands combined here. But can you give me a sense for that particular story, and also maybe how that dovetails with what you see today in our conversations about mental illness?
Sure. So that, I was really struck by that case too. And this was, when I was working on my previous book, I got a private tour of the Seward House Museum, and the young education director, in addition, she was really interested in Frances and thought that historians had not given her enough due. So she took me down into the basement kitchen, which was where she harbored fugitive slaves. And then she took me into Seward's, William Henry Seward's study. And she climbed up the top of the library ladder, and she pulled down this very thick medical textbook. And it had just been published when that William Freeman case came to, when Seward decided he was going to take on pro bono the defense of this black man. And Frances became, she was home when the murder happened. And it was the young black man who committed the crime, he was mentally ill and he had, he confessed to it right away. There was no question of who had done it. And he killed four members of a white, upstanding white family in the next town over, Fleming. So Henry was away, and Frances was there, and their entire neighborhood was, you know, ready to lynch this young man. He was arrested soon after he had committed the crime, and she could hear this procession going up South Street where they lived, and she could hear the cries of their neighbors saying, "Lynch him, lynch him." Someone threw a rope over a tree. So she wrote all of this to Seward, and she said, this is all, you know, I cannot believe that this is what our neighbors are advocating. And moreover, I don't understand this crime. So this young man had been an inmate at the Auburn, at the state prison in Auburn. And so she said, what could drive anyone to commit such a crime? And so she urged Henry. Everyone else said, do not take up the defense of this man. And nobody else had any desire to do so. And she urged him to do it. And she said she basically thought it was his moral duty. And Martha told her husband that it was his moral duty to serve as the co-counsel on the case. So there were these two friends and their husbands defending this black man who was clearly guilty, and who they said, so these two lawyers themselves were threatened with tar and feathering, and Frances and Martha were thought that was ridiculous. They wouldn't, you know, that didn't intimidate them in the least. And Frances served as his, basically as Seward's researcher on the case. So when this young woman pulled this medical volume down, she showed me the passage on the definition of insanity at the time. And you're right, people knew almost nothing. I mean, really, basically nothing about mental illness. And I think there had been only one other insanity defense launched before this one, but this was by far the most important nationally, got national press coverage. And Seward initially and Wright initially lost the case, but they won it on appeal. And I think that one of the reasons, I mean, she sought justice to the extent that she could in this case, but she herself was subject to various forms of mental illness, and she knew that there was something. That there was something not quite right, and we would, with her, because she was sick all the time, and we would now say that she had clinical depression and she had, you know, migraine headaches. So again, nobody knew, and there was a history of mental illness in the Seward family, and on her side, the Miller family, but nobody knew any of this at the time. So this was part of Frances' exploration of justice and then, you know, trying to understand what was the matter with her. And of course, I think it also had to do with the fact that she was shut up in her house all the time, and she wasn't allowed technically to do any of the things that she went on to do. So of course, that causes all kinds of, you know, internal turmoil.
And that case, you know, without having a name for it at the time, the Sewards were not only thinking about that case, but thinking about the community reaction, the people who, the newspaper that referred to him as the Black Demon, referred to Freeman as the Black Demon, the people who would say outright that, well, you know, he's a black man, of course he's going to be depraved. And without having a word for it at the time, they were kind of getting their heads around structural racism. Is that a fair way to look at that?
Yes, that's interesting. Although, so yes, I think that the Sewards and the Wrights certainly were. And if you read the transcripts of the trial, you can see what Seward was arguing, and David, when he made his argument too, and Seward made this clear. He cited the Bible. He said, "This man is your brother. You know, he is the same as you and I. The only difference is that, you know, he was sent, they found out that the crime he was sent to prison for, he had not committed. And while he was in prison, he was brutalized by a guard who picked up a piece of wood and whacked him on the side of the head with it. And it caused him to go deaf in one ear. And so this ultimately was what what Francis realized. This had caused him to go mad. And so this is what they were trying to argue in what Seward and Wright were trying to argue in court. It was difficult to do, though, at the time, because public opinion was 99.5% against them. And nobody, no other white resident of Auburn could, you know, was willing to countenance the fact that this man may have been driven to this terrible act by brutal mistreatment in prison and the subsequent insanity.
Talking to the author of a remarkable book called The Agitators, Dorothy Wickenden is executive editor of The New Yorker and the author of this book. And Dorothy is going to be participating in an event with the Neely Series Lecture at the University of Rochester. That is coming up on Tuesday, October 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. It's a virtual event. You can register via a link on our podcast page that we will post later today. And after we take our only break of the hour, there's a number of other issues that not only are fascinating in this book about our history, an important piece of American history, but also echo today, from equal wages to the voice of women and maybe how men saw the impact of women. So there's a lot more that we'll get to after we take this, our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, we talk with cast members of a local production called Bear. The play tells the story of a Catholic schoolboy who is in love with his roommate. The cast members share their perspectives on coming out and LGBTQ+ rights in 2021. In our second hour, we talk through issues related to redistricting, a proposal on the ballot in this year's elections.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and speaking of the way that newspapers reported on cases, whether it was the Freeman case or otherwise, or even just the way people shared stories and paraphrased and told the stories of black voices, I'm struck by what was written in the New York Times about your book by Jane Kamensky, who notes about Harriet Tubman the following. Though Tubman's deeds greatly eclipsed Wright's and Seward's, her voice remains muffled by intermediaries who ventriloquized her to varied ends. Racist reporters remade Harriet Tubman's infrequent speeches as tabloid spectacle. Her words were in the peculiar plantation dialect and at times were not intelligible to the white portion of her audience, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle said of her lecture to an immense mixed-race crowd in 1865. She appeared with a bandaged hand, the result, as she explained, of an incident during a trip by rail when she refused to give up her seat, anticipating the Montgomery bus boycott by nearly a century. But the reporter gave short shrift to Tubman's protest, instead mocking her use of so-called Negro phrases, which elicited shouts of laughter. Wickenden paraphrases the news item. She notes that even abolitionists who cherished Tubman's message conveyed Harriet's words in dialect, which she quotes sparingly. End quote. Tell me about that, how her voice was received at the time, and what you make of that now.
Well, I think yes, it's a good point, but you have to and this is something I struggled with throughout the book. This was the 1850s, and so you have to put yourself back in time, and Northerners were racist. Of course they were, and they used the N-word freely. Frances herself, you know, was chastised by her father when she was a young child, and she used it. But you see, Tubman's abolitionist friends, when she would talk to them, and then they would invariably take down what she said because it was the details of her life were so stunning. But they would take it down literally as they heard it, which was in dialect. And we today find that extremely offensive. But that's not the way they meant it at the time. So it's a very difficult, balancing act when you and how in my portrayal of Tubman too, one of the things I wanted to do was to take her off her kind of mythic pedestal and try to convey her as a flesh and blood woman with fantastic skills of so many different kinds, but who was flawed just as we all are. And, we learned so little about Harriet Tubman when we were growing up in our horrible, middle school textbooks. And I wanted to show her as her friends saw her, but obviously I didn't, I didn't quote her in dialect. I put that in the notes. So there, because she didn't ever learn to write, read or write, partly because of a terrible head injury she suffered when she was a young girl, when an overseer at a dry goods store picked up a weight and threw it at another enslaved person who was off the plantation without permission, and it hit Harriet Tubman in the head, and it practically killed her. It gave her sort of neurological problems for the rest of her life. That's probably one of the reasons she didn't learn to write, read or write. The other reason is that she was working nonstop every single day, throughout the night, many, many nights on her excursions. So there is no written record of her. So what you do have, as Jane Kaminsky is right, is this kind of, you have to kind of break through the prejudice and the ways in which people saw her at the time and try to imagine who she really was. And so what I finally came to in my depiction of her, what I tried to do was to recreate what I think she was effectively doing as she spoke privately to her friends and in public later when it became less dangerous to do so, which was to create an oral history of her the way she would have liked it to more or less to have appeared, because she told the same stories over and over again with very little variation. And so it is, even though she didn't tell the dates and it was a little bit hard to kind of piece it together, scholars have done a terrific job of gathering whatever, documentation there is. And so I was able to draw on that and then, take with a grain of salt some of the accounts as they came down to us. And in the end, there was quite a bit to work with. It just wasn't the same as, a kind of fully documented life.
Well, and on the subject, by the way, of compromise in the way that politicians often compromise and agitators are a little bit more urgent, you write a little bit about the Clay Compromise and how Harriet Tubman showed just how mistaken Henry Clay was about the pacifying effects that he saw that compromise possibly making. So you had the Fugitive Slave Act, the Clay Compromise, and all of which turning her into what you called a guerrilla operative, marking the beginning of her career or her years on the Underground Railroad. For those who don't remember the Clay Compromise, can you just describe a little bit about maybe Harriet Tubman, the impact of the Clay Compromise and what we can take from how that impacted Harriet Tubman?
Yeah, so the biggest clause in the Clay Compromise, the Compromise of 1850, was, as you say, the Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed slaveholders from the South to go into northern states where slavery had long since been abolished and seize for arrest, with the aid of local constables, people whom they claimed to be their property. In some cases, these were formerly enslaved people that they so-called owned. In other cases, they picked up, in these sweeps, they picked up free African-American men and women. And then there was this very pro forma, the individual was taken before a federal commissioner, and it basically all of them were then, forthwith sent back into or sent into slavery. So this caused Harriet Tubman, was, as you can imagine, was completely catalyzed by this. And she told a friend, I think it was a friend in Canada, that when that act was passed, she said, and she was just beginning her Underground Railroad operations, and she said, I wouldn't trust my people with Uncle Sam no longer, and I took them all clear off to Canada. So she made a dozen trips, that, as far as we know, into the Eastern Shore, got her entire family, you know, rescued her entire family, and then as many other enslaved people as she could. And as she said, she took them all the way up to Canada through Pennsylvania and all the way across New York State, towns which included Troy, Syracuse, Auburn, Rochester, and then across the Niagara River into Canada. So she was herself completely catalyzed by that. And then remember, her friends, especially in New York State, but also in Boston and Philadelphia, were also experiencing the effects of the Fugitive Slave Act. So Frances wrote about it to her husband and her oldest son. And she said, you know, men and women who we have long regarded as, you know, upstanding members of our community are being seized and sent back into slavery. Where it will all end, no one knows. Mm. So at that point, Frances became kind of a go-between with Seward, who was in Washington, remember, extremely conservative, heavily, at that point, Democratic, pro-slavery. And so he was getting a slightly distorted, more than slightly distorted perspective from Washington. She would report to him what all of his constituents in this very radical, you know, part of New York State were saying and doing. And, of course, they included her. This was, again, part of her way of saying to him, you have to listen to what the abolitionists are saying. These Southerners are invading our state and imposing on us laws that we do not support, in fact, that we have condemned. So it was a completely catalytic piece of legislation, probably the most in American history. And it was effectively you began to see the beginnings of the split that could never be healed between North and South.
On the list of things that people might learn from this book, how did I not know the story that Susan B. Anthony had quit her job as a school teacher rather than accept a salary of $2.50 a week when men were paid $10? And on the subject of equal wages, when the Wrights had enough money to hire a seamstress to help with the sewing, Martha wanted to pay her the same rate as they paid the man who helped with outdoor chores. And David replied that equal wages would be a curse to the community, raising the price of labor and setting people by the ears. Besides, a man had a family to support. End quote. Man, even today, those are some jarring words to read about. Tell me a little bit about wages I imagine there was no surprise for you, but I was going to ask you if you had any surprise at how vehemently David felt about that.
Well, I was a little surprised because David was he was what they called a reformer. So he was very much, he was a member of the temperance movement, as Martha and Frances were. He was an abolitionist. He read Frederick Douglass's abolitionist newspaper, The North Star, out of Rochester. He read William Lloyd Garrison's newspaper, abolitionist newspaper out of Boston. But interestingly, even though Frederick Douglass, both Douglass and Garrison were, you know, again, way ahead of their time. And so along with abolition, they wrote about women's rights. But David Wright just couldn't stomach that idea. He had a more conservative upbringing, and he just couldn't get his head around that fact. However, Martha kept at him over the years and kept sending him examples of how important it was for women to have equal rights. And after she died, he wrote an unpublished memoir, which I found in her papers, to their children. And he said something to the effect of, my dear children, I may not have done anything of particular note in my life, but your mother absolutely did. What she did was, you know, extraordinary. So he, you know, as an older man, he was a feminist. So that was no small feat. One of Martha's triumphs on that score.
Well, it took a while for some people. I mean, you note in the book that it was, we're talking about an era around 1850 that was, as you say, still 66 years before the first woman, that was Jeanette Rankin of Montana, who was elected to Congress. You're right that Rankin's opponent, one newspaper reported, killed himself because of shame over his defeat and voters' chance, beaten by a woman. Well,
yes.
The agitators in this book, of course, had many, many ways to achieve what they wanted to try to achieve without getting elected to Congress, even though it would be decades before women were elected to the halls of power. And today, we see a lot of civil disobedience or different forms of protest. You've got sections later in your book about some of those tactics and techniques. And I wonder today, when you see the forms of protest that take place now, what parallels you see and what parallels you also might see in the way that power is reacting to these forms of protest?
Yes. So I see these women and all the men and women they worked with as laying the groundwork for the grassroots movements that we see today. And I kept being struck by this in different ways as I wrote the book. It took me a number of years to write it. So when I began the book, Barack Obama was the first black president. That was, you know, I thought it served two terms. So it seemed America was like, you know, moving rapidly forward on the track that these women had, you know, very much hoped one day would be achieved. And then that was followed by the presidency of Donald Trump. And some of the movements that we now know, you know, everyone now knows around the world and has some form of them, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. We know now that misogyny is, if not as prevalent as it was, you know, in 1832, it is pretty darn prevalent. And it's in some ways more so because women are in the workplace and a lot of these attacks happen in the workplace or as a result of the fact that women are out in public. And hold positions of power. And then, you know, the other very obvious thing is voting rights, which these women believe in absolutely, even though you cite Susan B. Anthony. So even though, you know, in the late 1860s, Susan B. Anthony and her ally, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and also Martha's until that point, you know, they were both for the women's vote and for the black male vote. But then when it came to a decision, it was clear Congress wasn't going to pass both at once in the 14th and 15th Amendments. Then Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, well, votes for all or votes for none. And so we are not going to support the black male vote. And they became really racist in a very ugly way. But Frederick Douglass, who was a friend of all of theirs, in the end, in 1888, he gave this he forgave them everything, and he gave this incredible tribute to what they had accomplished. And he said, you know, it was one thing for us to fight for the rights of black men and women. It was even more remarkable for women to do what they did.
I do feel that in the last probably part of a decade, there's been kind of a growing movement in some activist circles to sort of cast out the Susan B. Anthonys of the world, the white women, the white suffragists who there is understandable anger about the division along racial lines that you just cited. What I wonder is how. How do we sort of make peace is the wrong word, but how do we sort of go forward understanding just how complex that was and how meaningful is it about what Frederick Douglass said about it before his passing, as opposed to sort of refighting all of this as it has been happening?
Yeah, exactly. And what I would say is this is one of the reasons we all need to learn this history, this hidden part of our history, which, you know, until the past, 25 years, wasn't told at all, really. And it was feminist scholars who began to bring out some of this, this part of the first women's movement. But I am completely with Harriet Tubman in this regard. And given her experience, other women would have been broken or deeply embittered by what she had experienced, and then would have seen what Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony did as completely unforgivable. But she didn't. She spoke before Black women's groups, and she got on the stage in Rochester with Susan B. Anthony to talk about, who had invited her to speak before a women's gathering for women's rights, probably for suffrage, women's suffrage. And this was quite late on, and Anthony had become, sort of unspeakably racist. And Harriet Tubman just got up there and she spoke. She said what she wanted to say about her own life and the importance of equal rights. And she just refused to divide the world into Black and white. She thought that was just going to create more division and more rage. And we see versions of this, as you say, not only in the March on Washington, where it became quite clear that this was still this tendency to kind of split off, mm-hmm. for white women to not include Black women to the extent that they should. I find this just absolutely so dangerous and so wrong. And I want white women to understand that Black women have been completely there on the front lines from the beginning.
From the beginning.
So you mentioned Harriet Tubman. She spent the war years in Port Royal, South Carolina, as a spy for the Union Army. On her way back, she was on a train and she was carrying her half price ticket because she had been a member of the Union Army. And she, as you alluded to, she was essentially beaten up by a conductor who forced her into the smoking car and broke her ribs. And that's why she was wearing that bandage on her arm. And she spoke. She stood up and she spoke right to him. He's brutalizing her. And she says, "Don't you call me." He called her a colored woman. And she said, "Don't you call me that. I'm a Black woman. I'm as proud of my race as you are of yours."
Stories like this and more in this remarkable book, The Agitators, Dorothy Wickenden. Grateful for your time in the book. Thank you for making it for us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The Neely Lecture Series, next Tuesday, 6 o'clock. We'll post a link. From the whole team, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.